Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Well, not one of the over 400 Trump supporters who are facing criminal charges in the January 6th attack on the Capitol has been brought to trial yet on those charges. And that's normal. That's kind of the timetable these things take. It doesn't happen that quickly. But another Trump supporter who was not at the Capitol on January 6th, but committed a federal crime for Donald Trump 2 days later, on January 8th, has already gone on trial in federal court in New York City for that crime. And last week, the jury returned a verdict in that case after the Trump supporter took the witness stand in his own defense to testify under oath that his threats to assassinate Nancy Pelosi and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Chuck Schumer were just jokes. The defendant, Brendan Hunt, 37 years old, has been in courtrooms before. His father was a family court judge in New York City. And before he was arrested on federal charges of threatening to assassinate members of Congress, Brendan Hunt was a clerical worker in the New York State court system. It must have helped when he was applying for that job that his father was a judge in that same system, but his father could not help him on the witness stand in federal court when he was asked under oath by federal prosecutor David Kessler about his jokes. Question. We played a video where you referred to killing the juice. Do you remember that? Yes, I remember that joke. It was in very poor taste, and I never uploaded that video. Now, the kill your juice video was in poor taste because kill the juice means kill the Jews, right? Yes, that was in very poor taste. Right. You were joking about killing the Jews, right? Yeah, that's sort of a thing that was said a lot online as far as making offense comments and things. Hitler memes are very prevalent online. Yeah, I'm not asking you what's online. This video wasn't online. I'm saying you decided to make a joke about killing the Jews. Yes, I did. The online world that Brendan Hunt is referring to is the Trump-supporting online world, where he says Hitler memes are very prevalent. The prosecutor asked about something else in that same video. Question. And in that video, you said George Floyd was a porn star and a drug addict who died of his own addictions. Do you remember that? Answer, yes. Question, was that a joke? Answer, no. In establishing this Trump supporter's motive in threatening to kill members of Congress, the prosecutor asked, you thought it was a fake election, in fact. And Brendan Hunt said, quote, I believed the president. The two leaders Brendan Hunt seems to believe the most are Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler. Quote, question, you wrote, Trump should just declare martial law, cancel the transfer of power, and round out the domestic enemies of the republic. The military and the American people would back him. During Hitler's first term in office, circumstances were such that it was necessary for him to override the democratic process and become the absolute leader of his country. Trump should probably do the same if necessary. Did I read that correctly? Answer, yes. On January 8th, 2 days after the invasion of the Capitol, Hunt posted a video entitled, Kill Your Senators. In that video, he said, quote, we need to go back to the U.S. Capitol when all of the senators and a lot of the representatives are back there, and this time we have to show up with our guns and we need to slaughter these mother. In previous Facebook post, Brendan Hunt identified Nancy Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Chuck Schumer as high-value targets, saying, quote, they really need to be put down. These commies will see death before they see us surrender. In his closing argument to the jury, prosecutor David Kessler echoed the prosecution in the execution in the murder trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. There was an echo of that closing argument that we heard in that case when he said that you could believe your eyes. You could believe what you saw Brendan Hunt's videos. You could believe what you saw there. You could believe what you heard him say on those videos. Quote, this is a case in which the defendant told you everything you need to know. You heard him repeatedly threaten to kill members of Congress. He literally said, I shoot them and kill them. He called for executions. He called members of Congress high-value targets. And the defendant also told you why he made these threats, to interfere with Congress's work in certifying the results of the election and to retaliate against Congress, all of the of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, for certifying the vote. He said members of Congress were traitors. They should be scared to be in public. They should go out with bodyguards. And he said he wanted to broadcast those threats out to the world. What the defense called a joke or statements protected by the First Amendment, the prosecution called a true threat to murder. The prosecutor read the Facebook posts to the jury in his final argument. Quote, if you're going to shoot someone, go after a high-value target. Get like Pelosi, AOC, or Schumer. They really need to be put down. We want you to hold a public execution of Pelosi, AOC, Schumer, etc. A member of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's staff testified that they took that threat seriously. The defense stressed the point that Brendan Hunt took down the Kill Your Senators video the day after he posted it. He took it down. So what could be the problem? In his final argument, David Kessler, the prosecutor, said, once you make a threat to kill members of Congress for doing their jobs, you've committed a crime. It doesn't matter if you take it down later. You know, in terms of taking the video down, you wipe your fingerprints off a knife you used to stab someone. That's not evidence that you didn't commit the crime. That's evidence that you knew you committed the crime. He made the choice. He chose to cross far over the line and decided to commit a crime. He made a choice to threaten and kill members of Congress for doing their jobs and chose to threaten them repeatedly. That's what the law does not permit. Ladies and gentlemen, you didn't leave your common sense downstairs with your cell phones when you came into court today. You take it with you. You take your common sense with you when you go to deliberate, and you should use that common sense. You should use it to evaluate the evidence that's before you. And when you do, I submit, you will see that your common sense and the evidence shows you that there's only one verdict supported: guilty. The jury unanimously found Brendan Hunt guilty of the true threat of murder of members of Congress, a crime he committed because, as he said under oath, quote, I believed the president. That was his motivation in threatening assassination. I believed Donald Trump. Brendan Hunt will be sentenced next month. He faces a maximum sentence of 10 years in federal prison. Leading off our discussion tonight, Andrew Weissman served as FBI general counsel and chief of the criminal division in the Eastern District of New York. He is an NBC News and MSNBC legal analyst. Also with us, Nina Polano, a reporter for Courthouse News, who was covering the Brooklyn Federal Court trial of Brendan Hunt. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you. Nina, let me start with you. I know you got to speak to some of the jurors after this case, and it seemed to go in to be submitted to them by the prosecution as a very, very, very clear case. Is that the way they took it in the jury room?
From what we heard from the jurors, and there were a few other reporters on the ground, we were able to catch a few folks on their way out. The jury was very much on the same page. We heard that someone told me it was explicit, the word she used, and that it was very clear based on the evidence. And she also pointed out to me that, you know, the jury made a point of ruling on the evidence and not on the motions. Of course, there was a lot of material, as you just mentioned, that could cause some, you know, emotional reactions among jurors. And so she was careful to point that out.
This prosecution is much quicker than what we're seeing in Washington. But then it's the only case that this particular U.S. attorney's office had like this to prosecute. And that must clear up some resources and make this a little quicker.
Absolutely. And it's also, you know, quite a different case. It was taken down shortly before the inauguration, precisely because the FBI was very concerned about the threats that were made by the defendant. And then Pam Chen, the judge in charge, you know, did what you're supposed to do, which was, this is a relatively simple case. The discovery was turned over and she set a trial date. And in spite of COVID, she managed to hold a fair trial. I do think something Nina said is important to note, which is that the jury here only found one of the four grounds in terms of finding that the defendant made a threat to assault or murder a member of Congress because of what he or she did in their professional capacity. It did not find three of the four grounds. And that really shows, I think, that the jury was very careful to separate out the truly offensive comments here and to really look at the worst of the grounds, which was the January 8th video. And I think the reason that the jury did that is that the defendant surprisingly took the stand. And in addition to saying things that were obviously preposterous, that this was like a comedy club routine that he was trying out, that was the one time that he really reflected and took time before he posted a video of himself that he created. And it made it very hard for the jury then to say, you know, this was just because he was taking a lot of drugs, which was one of his other defenses. So I think they clearly, you know, bent over backwards to try and give him a fair trial. But the proof, as you noted, was overwhelming here.
And Nina, the point about, you know, he put this video up, he took it down the next day, the video that got him convicted. How much did the defense rely on he took down the video? How much was the defense counting on taking down the video, getting him off the hook for this crime, when the prosecution was saying, all you have to do is put that video up and you have committed the crime the moment that video goes up?
Right. I think we heard the mention of the videos having been taken down, sprinkled in throughout the trial. That point was made, you know, to me the most strongly during summations, when Brendan Hunt's attorneys brought up that all of the content that, you know, as we just mentioned, all of those four statements that were part of the charge, each of those statements had been taken down. The Facebook posts that named specific members of Congress had been taken down when Brendan Hunt deleted his Facebook. One of the comments that was part of the charge on the website Parler was offline when that entire website went defunct, when Amazon took it offline. And then the video itself that ended up being the basis of the conviction was taken down. Sort of that was, I think, summarized in the closing arguments. But, you know, as you read, David Kessler's rebuttal to that was to bring up the analogy of wiping your fingerprints off a knife. And I can imagine that may have been powerful for the jury.
And Andrew Weissman, this defendant was like some of those Trump supporters we saw invading the Capitol, who were wearing their support for Hitler on their jerseys. He's one of those people. He also has horrible things to say about a lot of other subjects, that he was not charged with any criminal conduct over that. And the prosecutor made that very clear, because a lot of this came out because of his cross-examination. The prosecutor said he's not being prosecuted for his views about the Sandy Hook shooting or racism or white supremacy or Dylann Roof's manifesto or the election or his political views or his views or any other controversial topic being debated right now in this country. He's not charged with any of that. And he's not being prosecuted for any of that. The defendant is being charged with threatening to kill members of Congress for doing their jobs. And that's such an important distinction because there was so much information about his hateful, crazy, anti-Semitic and racist beliefs that came out in this trial. But he wasn't being prosecuted for any of that.
Absolutely. And, you know, Judge Chen, you know, who's a really terrific federal judge, had actually excluded a lot of that evidence precisely because it could inflame the jury, as Nina said, could go to their emotions. But when the defendant decided to testify, that is known as opening the door, because by contesting his intent and saying that's not what he was intending to do, that it was he was in a drug-induced state, that this was just a joke, he opened the door to this kind of evidence coming in. I don't expect, you know, absent a defendant taking the stand that you're going to see that in D.C., you know, this being repeated.
Andrew Weissman and Nina Polano, thank you both very much for joining us on this important story tonight. Really appreciate it.
Welcome.
Thank you. Coming up, the people who attacked the Capitol on January 6th are facing federal prison for believing the big lie that Donald Trump told them about the election. But Republicans have another lie that they have been telling for decades, even though Democratic presidents have repeatedly proved that big lie is not true. That's next.
Radio Andy.
Hey, it's Andy Cohen. Join me on Andy Cohen Live, where it's just you, me, and some of the world's biggest celebrities.
Paris Hilton.
Chelsea Handler.
Seth Rogen.
I love you, Miley. Thank you so much.
You can listen to Andy Cohen Live at home or anywhere you are. No car required. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
I think it's about time we start giving tax breaks and tax credits to working class families and middle class families instead of just the very wealthy. And here's what the American Family Plan doesn't do. It doesn't add a single penny to our deficit. It's paid for by making sure corporate America and the wealthiest 1% just pay their fair share.
Donald Trump predicted that if Joe Biden became president, the stock market would immediately collapse. CNBC reports the stock market is performing the best it has ever performed during the first 100 days of a presidency going back to at least 1953. The stock market continues to rise, even as President Biden is promising an increase in the corporate tax rate. And that's because the stock market seems to know that in 2013, when the capital gains tax was increased by the Obama administration, the S&P 500 increased almost 30% in what turned out to be one of the best years for stocks in 20 years or so. During the Reagan years in 1986, when the capital gains tax was increased, the stock market continued to increase by nearly 40% through most of 1987, according to the New York Times. And that is why when Republicans tell you that tax increases proposed by Democratic presidents are going to be bad for the economy, they never give you examples of when that happened. When President Obama raised taxes on top income earners, Republicans unanimously stood in opposition to that, with Republican House Speaker John Boehner echoing what Newt Gingrich had said 20 years earlier about Bill Clinton's tax increases. And I had a chance to discuss both the Obama and Clinton tax increases with Newt Gingrich on Meet the Press in 2012.
The problem for Boehner is how does he give on rates? He said this the other day. I oppose tax rate increases because tax rate increases cost American jobs. That gives you no room to give on rates. It is, by the way, not an original thought. who said this? The tax increase will kill jobs and lead to a recession, and the recession will force people out of work and onto unemployment and actually increase the deficit. That's Newt Gingrich in 1993 on the Clinton tax increase. And those of us who were working on the other side of that tax increase, Newt, have been waiting for your apology for 20 years for being completely wrong about that.
I don't agree with you.
Well, but the economy soared. No one lost a job because of that tax increase.
Baloney.
There was no recession. You said there'd be a recession. There was no recession.
Joining us now, Jason Johnson, professor of politics and journalism at Morgan State University and a political contributor for The Griot. He is an MSNBC political analyst. Also joining us, E.J. Dionne, opinion columnist for The Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is a professor of public policy at Georgetown University. And now we are going to have a meeting of the faculty club with the two professors here. Professor Johnson, as the younger among us, let me start with you. Are you surprised to learn how long Republicans have been saying, oh, this Democratic president is going to ruin the economy with this tax increase, no matter how much evidence we have that these Democratic presidents, Clinton, then Obama, raising taxes has not harmed the economy in any way?
Yeah, Lawrence, this is the thing. In my lifetime, as junior faculty here, in my lifetime, the pattern has generally been Republicans heat up the economy, then drag us into a recession, then a Democrat, whether it's Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, or now what appears to be Joe Biden, ends up having to pull us out of the ditch. Like, that's the overall historic story here. But the second thing is this idea of big spending being a problem, and we got to cut taxes and all these things, and we're concerned about deficits. Those things only seem to be a concern of the Republican Party when there's a Democrat in office. When there's a Democrat in office, suddenly they care about deficits. When it's a Republican in office, they can spend, you know, $100,000 on a hammer for a new fighter jet that we don't need. They can spend all sorts of money that they want. And I think in particular, when you look at what Joe Biden is trying to do right now, the last time you had a Democratic president try and push through this much money into the social safety net, it literally launched the Tea Party in 2009 with Barack Obama. So, I mean, literally, the Republicans always seem to get angry at investments into the economy, which they then end up benefiting from down the road, but blaming the people who came up with the policy.
All right. I want to continue the chorus of this with Kevin Brady. He's the Republican, top Republican on the House Ways and Means Committee. And this is only 12 seconds of pain to listen to him doing the latest version of this Republican story about Democratic tax increases. Let's listen to this.
These are dramatic increases in taxes that have real impacts on jobs here in America. And there's no question, in my view, this is going to sabotage the jobs recovery. It will drive jobs overseas.
Professor Dionne, why didn't it do that before? Why didn't it do that every other time Republicans have told us this is what the Democratic tax increase will do?
You know, this argument really goes back a long way. One of my favorite New Yorker cartoons, going back decades, it's two wealthy guys sitting in the plush chairs at their men's club, smoking cigars. And one turns to the other and says, I don't understand it. Every time these socialist Democrats take power, I make a pile. And it's happened again and again and again. And the thing about the money is Republicans act as if Democrats want to take this money and throw it into a dumpster fire. What does Joe Biden want to spend the money on? He wants to spend the money on roads, on bridges, on mass transit, on broadband, on educating the next generation of workers. Guess what? All that stuff is beneficial not only to people, but to businesses and to the economy. You know, and the last thing is supply side economics, which was drawn on a napkin, a very rigorous approach to making economic policy. Supply side economics says, well, if you raise taxes to 100%, people will stop working. Well, yeah, I buy that. If taxes were 100%, that might have an effect on people's activity. No one is proposing taxes of 100%. Biden is talking about bumping up the top rate about 3 points. He's talking about bumping up the capital gains rate on people who made a pile over the last 20 years. And so he's saying, let's invest some of this back in the economy, which will actually help grow business.
Professor Johnson, you know, in 93, when they were making this argument against the Clinton tax increase, I can tell you that on the Democratic side, when we had the door closed, there was some concern that there could be possibly some contractionary effect in the economy, because economic theory indicated that that was a possibility. But we had plenty of other reasons why this had to go forward, and it did. And in fact, the Democrats were very pleasantly surprised by how well it turned out economically. But there's a reason why you keep your mind open to what the possibilities are, because when you see the results of the experiment, you go, oh, okay, the Republicans, you can run this experiment as many times as you want, and they're simply never going to admit what the results are.
Well, think about it, Lawrence. You know, they passed this huge tax plan, this huge tax cut in 2017. Did everybody take those savings and keep their jobs through the pandemic? No, because those tax cuts did not end up benefiting a lot of regular people. Did we have the wildest Christmas ever in 2018 because of the 2017 tax cuts? No. Here's the thing, and this is what's often missed when we have these sort of right-left arguments one way or another. Yes, tax cuts can be beneficial. They can stimulate the economy if you cut the taxes or give benefits to regular consumers. But if you give the benefits to corporations, what do? They use it to buy back stock. They use it to invest overseas. They use it to raise the salaries of the executives. We've seen this with Delta Airlines lately. So that's the other issue here. When Republicans say, hey, we're going to cut taxes and put money in your pocket, no, they're cutting the taxes of people who already have plenty of money already, and they're keeping what they already have in their pocket while you're still out there struggling.
And that will have to be the last word in tonight's meeting of the Faculty Club. Professors Jason Johnson and E.J. Dionne, thank you both, professors, very much for joining us tonight. Really appreciate it.
And thank you, Professor.
Thanks a lot.
And coming up, Cecile Richards, who is not yet a professor, will join us. She's working on electing Democrats in the next congressional election in 2022. Joe Biden believes the best way to do that is to give Democrats big, big legislative achievements to run on. Cecile Richards will join us next.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Are you feeling optimistic? A new ABC News poll finds 64% of people are optimistic about the way things are going in this country. The Biden-Harris administration has done their part in delivering optimism by delivering nearly 250 million vaccine shots into arms and by delivering $1,400 COVID relief payments to most individual tax filers in this country, along with child tax credits for as much as $3,600 per child. 2 years after most presidential elections, the president normally suffers losses in his party's representation in Congress. The Biden strategy to preserve Democratic majorities in Congress is to give Democratic senators and members of the House legislative accomplishments they can run for in their reelection campaigns.
A once-in-a-generation investment in our families and our children that addresses what people care most about and most need. The investment we need to win the competition with other nations in the future, because we're in a race. We're in a race. It all starts with access to good education. The American Families Plan is going to provide access to quality, affordable child care, helping parents go back to work, providing a lifeline of benefits for children as they do better in school throughout their lives.
Joining us now, Cecile Richards, co-chair of American Bridge 21st Century. She is the former president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Cecile, thank you very much for joining us tonight. You've taken on a tough job trying to elect Democrats in a midterm election. What you have going against you is history, of course, because historically, presidents will lose seats in the Senate, lose seats in the House. If you lose one in the Senate, you've lost the Senate. But then we're living in the age where the impossible has happened. We just elected two Democratic senators in Georgia. So how do you make the impossible happen again in 2022 and elect and preserve Democratic control of the House and the Senate?
Well, I think you're completely right, Lawrence. We are living in unprecedented times. And one of the things we do know is that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and the Democrats in Congress have delivered immediately on so many things that they said they would do. And what I do know from 2018, we won the House back because of women. They turned out in record numbers, a historic gender gap. Women won the elections again in 2020. And I believe that's going to be the route in 2022, which is why I'm excited about this project with American Bridge. You know, women lost so much during COVID. 2.5 million women lost their jobs, and they are looking for government to do something about that. And the incredible thing is Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have done that, as you just said, not only shots in arms, but and stimulus checks to people, but reopening schools, focusing on things that women need to get back in the workforce, like childcare, like paid family leave. And I think these kind of practical, you know, economic issues that that women have been looking for help on, we're delivering on. And I think it's also important to remember that Joe Biden did the American Rescue Plan without a single Republican vote. And that difference, I think, can really make the difference for us in 2022.
Let's listen to the first woman vice president in history talking about what how this administration is targeting the needs of women.
When we are talking about those moms who need to walk on the sidewalk to get to the bus, pushing a stroller, walking a toddler, they are not identifying their problem through the lens of who they voted for in the last election. When we are looking at the capacity to grow the economic vitality of communities, including small businesses, and increase the productivity of a workforce, much less expand the workforce, what we know is that the reality is that people, regardless of who they vote for and with which party they're registered with, that's what they want. And that's what they want to see their government focus on.
And so far, Cecile, there's a poll showing that 67% believe that Republicans are compromising too little with Joe Biden, that they want to see much more Republican compromise with Joe Biden, which they are not getting.
Absolutely. And I think that's what we're seeing is the Republicans actually don't have anything to propose that they're doing. And that's why I think they're going after voting rights and other issues. I think what is important, and Lawrence, the thing that we need, why it's so important that we're doing this work now to educate women and all voters about what this administration is doing is we know what happened under President Obama. We passed historic healthcare reform, but we didn't stop to actually explain it to folks, let them know the benefits they were getting. We just kept going. And I think right now what American Bridge is committed to doing, what I'm committed to doing, is making sure that women know what's in the American Rescue Plan, what the jobs package is, and what the American Family Plan is, so that when it comes to 2022, it's not new news and they're ready to reelect Democrats in the Senate and the Congress.
Cecile Richards, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And please rejoin us as often as you can. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, Lawrence.
Thank you. Coming up, George Floyd's girlfriend testified about his struggles with opioid addiction. It was a story that some of the jurors might have been familiar with because millions of Americans have struggled with opioid addiction. 500,000 people in this country have lost their lives to opioid addiction, while one family was making billions upon billions upon billions of dollars for pushing opioids on this country. You'll hear that story next from one of Rachel Maddow's favorite authors, Patrick Radden Keefe.
Our story, it's a classic story of how many people get addicted to opioids. We both suffered from chronic pain. Mine was in my neck and his was in his back. We both had prescriptions, but after prescriptions that were filled, and we got addicted and tried really hard to break that addiction many times.
That was George Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross, sharing her story about George Floyd's addiction to opioids and her own addiction to opioids. Millions of Americans have faced that same struggle. Nearly 500,000 Americans have died from opioid overdoses in the 20 years between 1999 and 2019, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The opioid addiction epidemic is the result of the greatest marketing success in pharmaceutical history by a company called Purdue Pharma, which from the start aggressively promoted OxyContin, urging the company's sales reps to create, quote, a blizzard of prescriptions. Those sales reps were told to tell physicians that there was nothing addictive about OxyContin. Purdue Pharma created millions of OxyContin addicts, many of whom moved to heroin when they couldn't get OxyContin. Purdue Pharma was controlled by the Sackler family, a family that took home billions and billions of dollars from the opioid drug trade. No member of the Sackler family has been sentenced to prison, while El Chapo is serving a life sentence plus 30 years in federal prison. This story of drugs, death, and corporate greed is told brilliantly by our next guest in his new book, Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Joining us now is Patrick Radden Keefe, staff writer at The New Yorker and one of Rachel Maddow's favorite writers about anything, according to what Rachel told us at the beginning of this hour. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
And I just want to begin with this tweet that you put out about your father noticing. He said that he noticed that you're doing a Lawrence O'Donnell and dropping your Boston accent for professional reasons. I leave it to you, Patrick. Should we drop the Boston accent for professional reasons so America will understand what we're saying? Or should we do this in our native tongue?
Should we go full Boston? I don't think your audience could handle it.
Yeah, it would scare people. It would. They would have to. They'd have to have a translator ready. Patrick, I did the narration of a documentary we did here at MSNBC over on this subject. But you know, 1 hour of television compared to what you've delivered in this book, there's just no comparison. And so for me, it was filling in so many of thousands of details that I didn't know. And what I knew was horrific before I opened the pages of this book. For you, what was it for you that you just the moments where you just kind of had to stop what you were doing and just say, I can't believe they did this.
Well, there were a lot of them along the way. I mean, I had originally written a piece in The New Yorker in 2017 about Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. And at that point, I didn't have access to the kinds of documents that I would eventually get and the kinds of sources that I would eventually develop. So a lot of it was me imagining the conversations they were having behind closed doors. What I found in the book was this paper trail really establishing kind of what they knew and when they knew it, which I found really shocking. I mean, to take just one example, when Purdue Pharma is getting ready to launch OxyContin, they realize that that doctors believe that oxycodone, which is the opioid that's the main ingredient, was weaker than morphine. Now, it turns out that's not true. It was actually stronger than morphine, about twice as strong. But there are these emails in which senior people in the company say, doctors have this wrong. They think it's weaker, and we want to sell this to a wider range of people. So let's not do anything to correct the doctors and make them realize that they have this wrong.
Yeah, there's also a change in medical culture that Sackler was promoting, which was that you don't have to live with pain, that there's no reason for any patient to endure pain at any moment. And the older school thought was, well, there's a certain amount of pain you might have to deal with because our alternatives to that are addictive.
Yeah, so you get a sea change really in the culture of prescribing. And part of what I was trying to do with this book is the opioid crisis is obviously an incredibly complex public health crisis. And there's many, many variables and factors to consider. But it's also true that this drug, OxyContin, was kind of the tip of the spear. And you see these very deliberate conversations, including members of the Sackler family and the company, Purdue, where they set about trying to kind of change the mind of the American medical establishment about how dangerous these drugs should be. And part of what they want to do is see them prescribed not just for cancer pain, end of life pain, but really all sorts of pain, even moderate, back pain, injuries you've got on the job, sports injuries. And so you can see the commercial reason why they might want to do that. But the way in which they pulled it off was this marketing campaign in which they said, turns out these drugs aren't addictive at all. I've interviewed many former sales reps from the company, and they told me again and again and again, they would meet with thousands of doctors across the country and say, it's addictive less than 1% of the time. That's what they would repeat, less than 1% of the time. We know now that was not true.
How much money did the Sackler family make on this drug trade, and how much have they sacrificed as a result of the law, at least civil law, not criminal law, catching up with them?
So it's interesting. You know, I mean, I think you look at this story, there's a tendency to think of it as a family saga or a story about big pharma. It's also a crime story. This is a company, Purdue Pharma, which pled guilty in 2007. To federal crimes of misbranding OxyContin, and then pled guilty again just a few months ago in late 2020 to a new set of crimes associated with the aggressive marketing of this drug. In between, we now know the Sackler family pulled at least $10 billion out of the company. So that's $10 billion of profit that they pulled out during that period of time when we now know the company was engaged in criminal misconduct.
Patrick Radden-Keefe, thank you very much for this book. I issue that thanks from myself and on behalf of Rachel Maddow, who I know is going to love it. Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and my best to your father, and I hope he approves of the way we handled this tonight.
Indeed. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll be right back with a last word from Elizabeth Warren. Senator Elizabeth Warren is now in a real position to write tax law because in January, in her eighth year as a senator, she became the newest Democratic member of the Senate Finance Committee with jurisdiction over taxation. But even as the junior-most member of the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Warren has been named chair of the Subcommittee on Fiscal Responsibility and Economic Growth. And last week, in her very first hearing as chair of that subcommittee, Senator Warren said this.
Tax reform is just about choices. We can let our roads and bridges crumble, not upgrade broadband, make no investments in childcare or getting lead out of drinking water, and let rich people keep paying taxes at about half the rate as everyone else. Or we can ask those at the very top to pay a wealth tax. We can require giant corporations to pay a tax on book profits. We can get serious about tax enforcement for the rich and powerful. Those three changes in the tax code would give us trillions more than we need in order to pay for President Biden's infrastructure plan and his care economy plan. It's all about choices.
Senator Elizabeth Warren's new book, Persist, will be published tomorrow and tomorrow night. Senator Elizabeth Warren will join us right here on The Last Word. That's Elizabeth Warren tomorrow night, 10 p.m. And remember when Joe Biden went to Georgia last week? Joe Biden spent his 100th day in office in Georgia, where he and First Lady Jill Biden met with former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter at their home last Thursday. We only saw Rosalynn Carter at the door in one shot. But tonight, the Carter Center released this photograph of the visit. Two Democratic presidents who won Georgia's electoral votes. That is tonight's last word.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details.
Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.